I'd had too many men's fingers creeping towards me as I fell asleep on buses. For about 7 hours, I sat beneath a dome light with a book open on my lap, watching the Indian scenery slip past in the dark. I could make out trucks, trees, the shapes of villages and mountains. I read and dozed. At first light, we pulled over at a roadside complex to use the toilets and have a cup of tea before climbing back on board. Then it was more trucks, trees, villages. My head ached and my stomach churned after so much time sitting still and so little food. Every so often I'd spot a snatch of gray river, a factory twirling smoke into the sky, a farmer using oxen to till a field. I was chastising myself for not having gone into Afghanistan, for having retreated. A few years earlier, I'd sat on the top of Mount Roraima and quietly vowed that I'd always push forward, no matter what. Each border I'd crossed since then had felt like a revelation. It was better than school. It was better than church. The book I was reading was called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. I'd lugged it all over India and Pakistan but hadn't cracked it, always choosing to read other books instead. Back in Calgary, the book had been passed around among some of my friends who were starting to make big decisions about whether or not to marry a guy, buy a house, or take a certain new job. Tolle's point seemed to be that the present moment mattered more than anything. If you could focus fully on the present, things like pain, guilt, and worry all dropped away, and you could then listen to your deeper self. And the deeper self would know what to do. By the time my bus crawled into the Indian city of Jammu, midway through the following day, I had turned the last page. My deeper self was now entirely and exuberantly in command, and it was now busy browbeating my other self for having dashed away from Afghanistan so full of fear. I found a station agent, got a refund on the rest of my ticket, and applied it to the cost of a new one. Headed right back down the road I just traveled, toward Peshawar and the Afghan border. As I waited for my next bus, the Italian woman's fate flashed through my mind. I shuddered on her behalf, but I wasn't her, and she wasn't me. Clementina Cantoni had been unlucky, I decided. I would be okay. I pulled into Kabul on a hot day in early June, having caught a $20 minibus ride over the Khyber Pass. The city had a distinct smell. Not the mix of garbage and sewer and smog that permeated the air of other Asian cities. Rather, Kabul seemed to be the site of some massive and unseen incineration, reeking of kerosene and wood smoke with an undernote of something more acrid, like melting plastic. My backpack and clothing would carry Kabul's scent for weeks, long after I'd left the country and despite multiple passes through the laundry. It was a beautiful, wrecked city. Armored military vehicles crawled like reptiles through the streets, alongside tottering donkey carts and bicyclists. Amputees from the Russian war begged in the markets. Women walked the streets cloaked in burqas, looking like giant badminton birdies or floating blue ghosts. Men in keffiyeh scarves sold mobile phone airtime from beneath umbrellas, next to shops selling shoes and Western-style business suits and kiosks full of Chinese electronics. The older neighborhoods, built into the rock-scabbed terracotta hills overlooking the city, with their half-rubbled, flat-roofed mud-brick buildings, looked like something out of the Old Testament, while construction cranes hovered over blocks of gray Soviet-style buildings being renovated with a flush of foreign aid. I'd made the trip with Imanuddin, a friendly, middle-aged rug seller I'd met in Peshawar, and one of his young sons. Imanuddin had emigrated to Pakistan decades earlier, but came home to Kabul when he could for visits with his family. In Peshawar, I'd stopped in for tea at his carpet shop almost daily. He'd shown me photo albums from his days fighting the Russians as part of the Afghan Mujahideen. He described Kabul in detail, from the noisy bird market downtown to the beautiful profusion of his mother's rose gardens. From the bus station, the three of us took a taxi to a neighborhood on the outskirts of the city where we were dropped off when the street narrowed into a lane. Imanuddin had loaned me an abaya from his wife, a draping black robe that was less smothering than a burqa and paired with a headscarf passed for modest. The abaya was about 6 inches too short, and I was aware of my jeans sticking out beneath its hem, exposing me for the imposter I was. Carrying our bags, we walk the rest of the way down a rocky path, hopping a trickling brook. Before we reach the gate to his family's compound, Amanuddin's relatives were streaming toward us, shouting their greetings. Kids, women, men, dozens of them. The women kissed me 3 times, alternating cheeks. Amanuddin's mother, wearing an indigo burqa, took my hand. Everyone swarmed over Amanuddin and his boy. Behind the wall were their 3 houses, wide and low, made from mud and hay, plus a small outhouse that served the whole family. After dinner that night, Amanuddin's mother showed me to a room with a mat on the floor and a candle lit on the windowsill. She settled me in wordlessly, her burqa removed, her cheeks sunken, her gray hair in 2 stalk-like braids down her back. On the floor, she stacked a pile of hand-woven wool blankets to protect against the evening chill, each one stitched with colorful yarn embroidery, thicker and heavier than any blanket I'd ever lifted. She disappeared for a few minutes, returning with a pot of tea and a dish of sweets on a silver tray. By then I was standing at the window, looking at the wide sky and the pale moon, thinking, I can't believe it. I'm really in Afghanistan. I caught sight of the dense rose bushes growing along the side of the compound walls. Their flowers lay red, robust, and wide open in the moonlight, exactly as Amanuddin had described them. On my 6th day in Kabul, Clementina Cantoni's kidnappers set her free. Nothing was said publicly about how this came to pass, what deal might have been struck, what concessions had or hadn't been made during the 3 weeks she'd been held captive. An Afghan minister would insist to the media that no ransom had been paid and no prisoners were released in exchange for her freedom. Outside of Kabul's Italian embassy, Cantoni waved wanly at the television cameras before disappearing inside to spend the night under heavy guard. The next day, she got the hell out, flying back to Italy, saying little about what had happened. On the day she was released, June 9th, 2005, I was oblivious. The truth is, I hadn't thought much about the kidnapped Italian woman since arriving in Kabul. Exploring on my own, I'd taken a taxi that day to a wholesale market area near the center of the city, which sprawled in all directions, straddling the banks of the Kabul River, devolving into a labyrinth of crooked alleys. I bought a plastic cup of raisins and apricots mixed with pistachios and honey-sweetened water and ate them with a spoon. I browsed through little shops. In one, I found a shelf stacked with bars of soap, their wrappers showing a photograph of a smiling woman's face, except that every face had been scribbled over with a marker. This was a fundamentalist Islamic move, something the Taliban once enforced strictly. Any images of things made by Allah weren't to be replicated by a human hand because it counted as playing God. Amanuddin had explained it to me. It was okay to paint or print a photograph of a car or a building, but not a person or animal. Idolatry was a sin. It was why, several years earlier, the Taliban had dynamited a pair of ancient grand statues of Buddha in the town of Bamiyan, causing a global outcry. I thought about buying one of the soaps as a souvenir, but staring at the blotted-out face of the Middle Eastern model gave me the creeps. Back outside, I wandered down tightly packed dirt lanes, weaving between shoppers, browsing the goods laid out on tables and blankets, dried fruits, pyramids of ground spices, mountains of polyester clothing, when I felt something drill into my back, the force of it like voltage from a wire. When I turned, the pressure increased. A young man was at my shoulder. His expression was bug-eyed. I realized then that it was a gun jamming into my ribs, some sort of pistol. Into my ear, the man said very clearly, "I will kill you. Give me your money." It was over before I fully understood what was happening. Only after I handed the man my wallet, a change purse I'd bought in Rajasthan with $300 in it, about half the money I had for the rest of my trip, and after the crowd had swallowed him up again, did my whole body start to shake. Frozen in place in the middle of the market, with men pushing their bicycles past me and women hurrying onward with their covered heads down, I began to cry. Months' worth of tears, it seemed, maybe even years. I felt lost and small. Every instinct seemed to have left me. I couldn't think of a thing to do but weep. My headscarf and too short abaya had done nothing to help me blend in. I felt fully unmasked as a foreigner, sobbing in a way I knew must appear ridiculous and childlike, but which I couldn't tamp down. For the first time in ages, I missed home. I missed my mother. I just wanted to be a woman standing on a street that I knew, in a place where I fit in. A crowd began to gather, men looking quizzical. Eventually, someone located an Afghan soldier who found a sympathetic taxi driver to get me out of there. A few days later, I used most of the rest of my money to buy a bus ticket back to Pakistan. From there, on a more meager budget than ever, I got myself to Delhi to catch my flight home. For a week, I carried a star-shaped bruise of that pistol in the soft spot below my ribs on my right side. It ached and changed colors and then very slowly faded away. But its message remained clear to me, like an asterisk added to what had been almost 7 months straight of heady travel, as if at last I'd hit some final fence line. "You don't fuck with Afghanistan," it was saying. Yet even so, there was something still flickering inside me, the pilot light that had fueled me all the way through and was not, even now, extinguished. The thing that said, "Yes, do." Chapter 9. The Start of a New Sentence. It was about 8 months later, in the winter of 2006, when I first spotted Nigel Brennan, a thin guy wearing a fleece jacket, cargo shorts, and hiking boots, sitting alone on an empty hotel veranda in Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia. I'd spent the summer and fall waiting tables in Calgary, stockpiling my money. I was now 5 weeks into what I figured would be a 6-month tour through Africa and the Middle East, so long as I stuck to a careful budget. This was my dream trip. Seeing Africa had been a goal since I first started traveling. Already I'd made my way through parts of Uganda and Kenya, taking buses over wide plains, passing long days alone. I felt awestruck and intimidated by what I'd seen, by the sweating city crowds and the thorny flatlands. How different the landscape was from Afghanistan's craggy splendor or the heavy lushness of South Asia. Even the sky looked uniquely African, flatter and wider, like blue chrome layered over the land. By the time I reached Addis Ababa, I was lonely. It seemed almost like Nigel had been waiting for me, though in reality he was just a traveler who happened to find a quiet spot to read a book, on a sagging couch on the porch of the one-star Barrow Hotel, right about the same time my taxi rattled up on the street out front. I felt an instant pull in his direction. He was in his mid-30s, I guessed. I recognized the cover of the book he was reading, a thick paperback travelogue by Paul Theroux called Dark Star Safari, which was becoming a cult hit among the backpacker crowd. I had devoured it twice. The first lines went like this: "All news out of Africa is bad. It made me want to go there." Carrying my bag past Nigel on my way to reception, I said, "Hi, how are you?" He looked up. He had blue eyes, an aquiline nose, and a handsome, unshaved face. "Oh," he said as if I'd woken him, "I'm good." He went back to reading. At the Barrow's reception desk, I handed over my passport and got a $10 room. A couple of extra frugal travelers had pitched sun-beaten tents in front of the reception area. My room had a stained carpet and was weakly lit, with a twin mattress and a small bathroom. On a tray over the sink lay a packet of African condoms, a customary gesture in a country working to lower its HIV rates, at a hotel that sometimes doubled as a brothel for locals, and amid intermingling travelers who tended to be young, impulsive, and charged up on adventure. I moved the condoms to one side, brushed my teeth, fished a pack of cigarettes from a bag, and went back out to find the guy on the porch. Cigarettes, for low-budget travelers, are a universal icebreaker. On the streets of just about any city or town, they can be bartered for directions or the use of a toilet. Among those traveling, they're an excuse to talk and to share. I flopped myself down on the chair next to Nigel and waved my pack of cigarettes. "Okay if I smoke?" I said. He shrugged. "Sure." At last he set the book down, pulling out a cigarette of his own. He was an Australian living in London, a photographer, he said, newly arrived in Ethiopia to shoot pictures for the International Rescue Committee to help promote some of its aid projects. He was traveling alone. He'd be in Africa for the next 3 months. The conversation flowed easily. Nigel had a ready smile. We talked for a while about the Theroux book. I quizzed him on how he'd gotten his start in photography. He said he'd realized how much he loved taking photos during a trip to India years earlier, prompting him to go back to school to get a photography degree. It struck me as glamorous to get paid to travel like that, to capture a foreign landscape or face, to offer it up to all the people who would never have the guts to go see it themselves. Nigel had thin, muscled calves, a quick laugh, and a thick Australian accent. He came across as self-assured, successful. He casually mentioned that he'd had a meeting with someone from the Times of London. I'd spent years studying magazines and newspapers and travel books, feeding myself on other people's impressions of the world while gathering my own. That Nigel was not just a photographer, but a photographer who lived in London, felt significant. And he seemed to wear it well, as if inhabiting exactly the life he'd planned for himself. It was getting late. I stood up and stretched, announcing that after the distance I'd come that day, I had to get some sleep. "I guess I'll see you tomorrow," I said. Nigel looked at his watch. "Actually, I'm on the 6 a.m. bus to Harar." Harar, I knew from my reading, was a walled city in the eastern part of Ethiopia, a historic Islamic trade center about 10 hours away. "Anyway, I hope you get some rest," he said. "Good luck with your travels." He reached again for his book. I masked my disappointment. He hadn't even asked for an email address. Maybe, I thought, this was the dividing line between journalists and backpackers. Walking back to my sparse room, I felt a ripple of confusion. Something about him had stirred me. He seemed to be resisting it, but I believed I'd stirred him too. Around 9 the next morning, I woke, showered, and headed out to the terrace. I was having my second cup of coffee when Nigel appeared at my table. He was dressed in the same outfit he'd been wearing the night before. In the daylight, he looked a bit older. The skin around his eyes creased when he smiled. "Hey, doll," he said, using an endearment that only an Australian man can pull off even half-winningly. "Looks like I'm back." His taxi, it turned out, had gotten marooned in the snarl of early morning traffic. He'd missed his bus to Harar by 5 minutes. The next one, he told me, wouldn't come for another 24 hours. A stroke of luck, it felt like. As Nigel dragged a chair to my table, something inside me clicked on. We liked each other, Nigel and I. We spent his extra day in Addis together, visiting the market, flirting gently. In the evening, we went dancing at a nightclub, drinking Tej, a sweet, potent honey wine. Nigel was intelligent, interesting. He'd grown up on a middle-of-nowhere farm outside of Goondiwindi, Australia, and knew how to do things like build barns and slaughter sheep. He used the word piss more often and with more flexibility than anyone I'd ever met. "I'm just pissing in your pocket," he'd say, or "I took the piss out of him, didn't I?" or "Let's hit the piss," or "What a piece of piss that was." He assured me that his family back home spoke the same way. London, he claimed, had buffed some of his rough edges. Back at the hotel, we went to his room. It seemed we might be beginning to lean in toward our first kiss. I was ready for it, happy for it, but instead, Nigel blurted out some news. He had a girlfriend back in London. I pulled back. I didn't kiss other women's boyfriends. It had been a long time since I'd kissed anyone at all. Suddenly we were both stammering. I hadn't realized I was saying I didn't know. "No," he said, "I'm sorry, my fault." He added, "It's a confusing thing." We sat back on the bed and passed a long moment staring at the floor. Nigel then started to talk. His girlfriend's name was Jane. She was also Australian, he said. They'd been together a long time, about 10 years, having met when they were quite young. They were in the midst of an agonizing, slow breakup, he said. It was her job that had taken them to London. That they were far from home and living together made it harder for them to extract from the relationship. It was sad, he said, but it was over. The trip to Africa was punctuation on the end of the sentence. I let it go at that. I wanted to be the start of a new sentence. I was charmed. He was different than the boy backpackers I had met on the road, a little cocky but also earnest. I thought it kind of noble, even, that he'd spilled the truth about the soon-to-be ex-girlfriend. I knew plenty of guys who wouldn't. I was a believer in fate, and something told me that despite our individual plans and our homes on different continents, Nigel and I were fated to be together. That night, we did a lot of kissing. The next morning, he caught the early bus for Harar. We promised to meet up again as soon as possible. For the next 6 weeks, it went like this. Nigel traveled and shot pictures for the aid group while I explored on my own as I'd planned it. We used email to arrange rendezvous, coming together for a few giddy days in one crossroads town or another, before staunchly resuming our travels. I took a punishingly hot 2-day bus trip over the border into Sudan, spent a week at a backpacker encampment at the Blue Nile Sailing Club in central Khartoum. I befriended a Sudanese businessman named Ayad, who showed up at the club in the late afternoons and took loads of camping foreigners for sunset rides in his powerboat, showing us where the Blue Nile fed into the larger Nile River, its waters flowing north toward Egypt. Despite the fact alcohol was banned in northern Sudan, he served cold beer from a cooler in the stern. When I asked how he got it, Ayad, wearing designer shades and driving at full speed, shouted, "Anything is available on the Nile." I also at one point got myself all the way to the border between Ethiopia and Somaliland, a breakaway state in the northern part of Somalia that had managed to keep itself out of the nasty civil war going on in the south. I was hoping to spend a few days in the city of Hargeisa, which I'd heard was pretty unwelcoming. I had another motive too. Like a lot of backpackers, I was a country counter. We were all looking to improve our numbers. Listing the number of countries we'd visited gave us a way to measure ourselves. Most country counters kept quiet about their numbers until they got over 30. After 4 years of on-again, off-again travel, I'd been to 46 countries. A trip over the next border would bring me to 47. The uniformed border guards, each with a Kalashnikov slung idly over a shoulder, took one look at me and started shaking their heads. "Not now. Too dangerous," I was told. I'm pretty sure "not now" meant not while Muslims around the world were feeling jittery and provoked. A few months earlier, a newspaper in Denmark had commissioned and published a group of satirical images of the Prophet Muhammad, setting off a furor among conservative Muslims. There had been riots and protests everywhere from Nigeria to Lebanon, and the controversy seemed to be continuing. I don't know if some faraway official had issued a dictum regarding foreigners in Muslim Somaliland, or if it was a gut decision on the part of the border guards in their squat concrete shack amid the swirling dust of eastern Ethiopia that I was bad news. But in short order, I was turned around and heading back where I'd come from, my country count stuck on 46. There was, I suppose, no upside to letting someone like me in. Nigel, meanwhile, was coming alive in Ethiopia. When we talked on the phone during our stretches apart, or I read his emails from an internet cafe, I could sense him firing on the cylinders of each new day. I recognized the feeling. He sounded exuberant, untethered, even while complaining that he was ground down by the long bus rides and the flies that crawled up his nose and the unending barrage of begging children. When we met up, we feasted on meals of chopped collard greens and dollops of mashed chickpeas spread over pancakey injera bread. We tossed our backpacks into the corners of grotty guesthouse rooms and threw ourselves into bed. He was strong and capable, and I loved the golden hair on his arms. I did my best not to worry about the girlfriend named Jane. When Nigel talked about her, he grew flustered. Sometimes when telling me a story about his past, I could tell he was editing her out of it. But mostly he didn't talk about Jane. He talked about me. He was soon to return to London, but before he did, we made one long excursion together into the brown desert of northwestern Ethiopia, across a legendary swatch of land called the Danakil Depression. I'd read about it during my pre-travel reading binge at home in a National Geographic story titled The Cruelest Place on Earth. The Danakil was far from anywhere and scorchingly hot. My Lonely Planet carried a brief mention of the area but didn't provide instructions or encouragement to go, which somehow made it perfect. We took buses until we reached a market village on the outskirts of the desert. The town was populated by a tribe called the Afar, Muslim nomads who made their living pickaxing salt from the flats on a distant edge of the Danakil, then loading it onto camels and trekking it many miles through some of the hottest weather in the world to sell to traders. The Afar women wore loose headscarves, and many had henna tattoos on their faces, three thin lines or a series of droplets on their cheeks. The Afar men were famous, apparently, for castrating their enemies. We wanted to see the salt mines. Nigel thought maybe he could sell some of the photographs of the miners to a magazine. I thought I'd try my hand at writing about the experience, possibly for a travel website or my hometown newspaper. After asking around, Nigel and I found a guide, a short, rotund Afar man with a face that was wrinkled like a walnut shell and a long gray beard into which he'd rubbed a rust-colored henna dye. Hereafter known to us as Redbeard, he spoke no English, but in an agreement brokered by a local guy who did, Redbeard said he'd take us out to the salt flats and back, a trek of about 10 days. We were joined by a solemn younger man, the Camel Whisperer, we called him, who said nothing in any language but had beautiful blade-like cheekbones and a shy smile and walked devotedly next to the four camels in our little caravan, one for each foreigner, one for Redbeard, and one for the luggage. Each animal also hauled two yellow plastic jerry cans sloshing with water. We rode behind Redbeard on a path that took us first across low hills of hard-packed sand and shrub and eventually out into the flaking gray expanse of the Sodium Flats. From atop our camels, Nigel and I sang songs, played 20 questions, and shouting over our shoulders at each other, told silly stories from childhood. He had spent his school years at a boarding school for rural kids, where he hated all the rules. He'd been angry at his parents for years afterward, he said, for sending him there. He tutored me on all things Aussie, why they loved Vegemite, how to shout, "Why the fuck not, mate?" as a kind of battle cry for life. We slugged water out of our bottles, let the sun broil our shoulders, behaved like high schoolers on a rambunctious first date. Only our first day was taking place in an Ethiopian desert, with Redbeard and the baby-faced Camel Whisperer quietly and inscrutably observing our every move. The unspoken assumption was that Nigel and I were married, which was why it was okay for me to rest a hand on his cheek, or for him to give my butt a playful knock as I pulled myself back into the saddled notch of my camel's back after taking a food break. I was coming to understand a few things about Nigel. He was less a photographer from London, at least not in the way I first interpreted it, and more a hopeful guy at the start of his career, even at the age of 35. He talked about wanting to do more with his photography, how the idea of being a war correspondent appealed to him. We talked about Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq, Somalia, all the places in the world where wars raged, all the places where a photojournalist would want to be. I told him about the week or so I'd spent in Kabul, staying with Imanuddin's family. Despite having been robbed there, I thought of it as intriguing and beautiful, a place I wanted to return. Nigel let me borrow his camera, a black Canon, as heavy as a brick, and play around with it, clicking through its settings and experimenting with what happened when you switched one soup can lens for another. He showed me how to frame a landscape shot, how to filter the bleach of the high sun. On our second night, we stayed in a tiny Afar village, a way station for the camel drivers transporting salt. Redbeard had dragged a wide, thin mattress from someone's twig home and put it out in the open air for us. There were zillions of stars blinking infinitely over the blue desert, slinging the occasional meteor, each one hooking through the sky on a quick shimmering tear before flaming out. It was impossible to look away. We watched for what felt like hours. I was just beginning to nod off when Nigel reached over and gave my hand a squeeze. "Know what?" he said. "Right now I can't think of anywhere in the world I'd rather be." He paused a second and added, "Or anyone else I'd rather be with." I knew what he was trying to say, and I was happy for it. The Danakil Depression is a surreal, sunken basin dozens of miles wide and long, over 300 feet below sea level in places. It's like a half-picked scab on the Earth's surface, with the guts of the planet oozing in its cracks. As we moved deeper into the depression, we saw spitting fissures and bubbling pools of yellow and blue sulfur, which thickened the air with its stink. Nigel and I stared at it all. We took photos we were sure were gorgeous and unforgettable, anything to document that the whole thing was real. Sometime on the fourth day, I stopped sweating. My thighs ached from all the hours clamped on the camel. My tongue felt heavy. My lips were cracked and sore. Even the desert bread Afar men were getting fried. During a midday break in our lumbering, I refilled my water a little woozily. Nigel and the camel whisperer walked a few yards away to pee. Redbeard swatted two of the camels until they dropped to a kneel. He slid the heavy saddles from the animals' backs and propped them up on the ground, stringing a canvas cloth between them. His efforts yielded a low, makeshift tent that created a slim puddle of shade, into which all four of us crawled in quickly within inches of one another, as if we had absolutely no choice in the matter, fell sound asleep. By evening, I was shivering and disoriented, feeling ice run up my spine, dehydrated to the point of delirium. After another few hours on the camels, we had bedded down for the night on the salt flat, the crystals like little razors pushing through our straw mat. Nigel dribbled water from a bottle down my throat. I said something to him and watched his brow furrow. I was babbling nonsense, my bearings slipping away. The sky rolled overhead. Later, Nigel would tell me he was sure I would die that night, that they'd have to rope my body back onto a camel to get me out, and the whole mess would be his fault. It didn't go that way, though. Early the next morning, I opened my eyes and sat up. I felt better, with just the slightest hint of headache. I shook Nigel awake. His eyes went wide. "Aw, thank God," he said, stroking my hair. "You gave us a fucking scare, you know." His relief seemed huge. I found it touching. I convinced Nigel there was no reason to turn back, that we should continue. I promised to drink extra water and keep myself fully covered from the sun. He went along with it, reluctantly. "You're pushy," he said, handing my backpack over to the camel whisperer to strap on the cargo camel. "Pushy, pushy, pushy." That day we followed Redbeard over the last miles to the salt mine. A dirty, grim outpost, the extreme reaches of an already extreme place, where maybe 200 painfully skinny Afar men dressed in shorts and t-shirts were using long sticks to pry up giant cement-like slabs of heavy gray salt, then chipping them into square tiles that could be bundled and loaded onto waiting camels. Upon arrival, Nigel and I disembarked from our animals, grinning with relief, stretching our backs and shaking out our sore legs as if finishing up a pilgrimage. As if we'd come to some end-of-the-road auberge and were about to have ourselves a soapy shower and a three-course meal. Because that's the thing about the exact moment when you get somewhere that has required effort. There's a freeze-frame instant of total fulfillment, when every expectation has been met and the world is perfect. We weren't thinking about the long trek back, or the fact that Nigel was still entangled with Jane, or even that the salt miners were staring at us with unbridled hostility. No, this was the moment before the moment when reality reasserted itself, which it promptly did, as one of the Afar miners spotted the camera in my hands and, pegging me for the invading alien that I was, scooped up a heavy chunk of salt and hurled it right at me. Chapter 10. A Camera and a Plan. From Ethiopia, I went on to Cairo, following my original plan. Nigel flew back to London, where he said he was going to break up with Jane once and for all. He would then move back to Australia. I'd get a work visa and join him there. I bought a cell phone so he could call me as I continued traveling, which he did almost every day. Our phone calls were quick. We were on tight budgets, but loving. The longer we were apart, the more perfect he became. I'd never in my life imagined I'd follow some guy to Australia, but it seemed like precisely what was supposed to happen. Then one afternoon he called me and in short order started to cry. The truth followed quickly, propelled by a rush of fully uncorked guilt. As it turned out, Nigel did not have a girlfriend in London named Jane. The woman in London named Jane was his wife. They'd been together about 10 years, like he'd told me in Ethiopia. What he'd left out was the part where they'd spent the last year of it married. They were still married, though it had been rocky, he said. He'd gotten himself, with her, with me, into the ugliest sort of jam and was confessing all around. On the phone, I could hear his breath catching as he spoke, his tone pleading. He was calling the marriage a mistake, and lying to me about it had been another mistake. For a few minutes, we were both sobbing until, without another word, I hung up on him, and stared at the yellowish high rises outside my Cairo hotel window as both my plans and my heart seemed to burn up on the spot. As I thought, did that really just happen? Then came the secondary thought as the recklessness of the last 5 months replayed in my mind, this time with married man subbing for London-based lover. How stupid am I? I felt adrift, cheated, alone. For the next few months, I traveled numbly through Egypt, then Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and Syria. I met people. I saw things. My cell phone buzzed with calls from Nigel, but I ignored them. In my weaker moments, I clicked back through my photos of Ethiopia, studying his face, looking for signs of guilt and fakery. Sitting at an internet cafe one day, I Googled Jane's name, wondering what she made of the whole mess, trying to guess at what kind of person she might be. I put labels on all of us. Her, me, Nigel. Good, bad, villainous, innocent, dumb, guilty. Or maybe it was just victim, victim, victim. I wasn't sure. I got past my heartbreak the only way I knew how, by making more plans, bigger plans. I bought myself a new camera, a fancy professional one, an upgraded version of what Nigel had carried with him in Ethiopia. In some ways, given my finances, it was an absurd purchase, but I saw it as an investment in my future. I'd watched Nigel use his photography to sponsor several months on the road. It didn't seem that illogical to think I could teach myself to do something similar. I was a traveler, after all, and the world was full of travel magazines. Who was to say I couldn't try to sell photos of the places I went? I wasn't thinking about a career, just a little income here and there. The goal was to keep myself moving. The camera became a salve, a new repository for my hope. I went back to Canada and spent the rest of 2006 waitressing to recharge my bank account. Meanwhile, Nigel never stopped calling. He was back in Australia in the middle of divorce proceedings. His family and his friends were mad at him, he said. Though the whole thing was uncomfortable and weird, I'd started picking up the phone when he called, feeling somewhere between still pissed and totally lonely. I was 25 years old, fully accustomed to the cycle of making money fast in a Canadian bar and then spending it slowly, as far out in the world as I could get. I knew how to stretch a dollar. Especially in Asia, I could travel on $15 a day without feeling hungry or uncomfortable. I still felt a knock of fresh happiness every time I reached a new place. I was also getting older, slowly outgrowing the flightiness of the people around me, both the waitresses back home and the travelers I met on the road. I didn't want a desk job, but I did want to be something more than a waitress. I went back to Calgary and took a photography class between waitressing shifts. I started to nurse a larger purpose, thinking that if I declared myself a photographer, something good would come of it. All the while, I continued to talk to Nigel, laughing a little bit more, wondering whether we were really fated to be together. Maybe it was his other relationship that had been the fluke and ours that had value. He lived in a house he'd built with his own two hands. He had a job he liked, working as a photographer for a newspaper in a small city called Bundaberg. It all seemed very stable and grown up. About 10 months after he broke the news about Jane, while I planned another trip through Asia for the winter of 2007, Nigel finally talked me into stopping for a layover in Australia. It wasn't instantaneous, the rebuilding of our romance, but it wasn't slow. I landed in Sydney on a February morning, and after fighting off a full-blown panic attack in the airport bathroom, I walked into the arrivals hall, where I watched Nigel turn and catch sight of me with a slow smile spreading upward. The beard he'd sported in Ethiopia was gone. He looked to be a paler, more neatly trimmed version of the person I'd known, dressed in new jeans and a pressed shirt. When he hugged me, it was firmly, as if placing me with a prolonged squeeze in his world. This kicked off a honeymoonish tour of Eastern Australia. We had 2 weeks before I was to continue on to Bangkok and then Delhi, where I had plans to meet Kelly Barker, my favorite travel companion from home. Kelly had shifted from waitressing into working as a flight attendant, which had perks for both of us. She'd given me a buddy pass for a discounted flight to Asia and was flying for next to nothing herself. In the meantime, Nigel and I climbed the harbor bridge, picnicked in a lush green park, and took a ferry to Manly Beach to play in the waves. We flew up the coast and booked a cabin on a small charter boat headed to the Great Barrier Reef, where we scuba dived on psychedelic-looking blue and yellow coral and swam silently among flapping rays and gliding turtles. At night, we drank a lot. We picked apart grilled pink prawns and mud crab, dipping the sweet meat into melted butter. We sat up late, talking in the balmy sea air beneath an unreal pantheon of stars before taking ourselves happily to bed. Still, I had flashes of paranoia. Was the man I'd met traveling, with whom I was now traveling again, the more authentic rendition of the guy who not too long ago had a wife, a flat in London, and an entirely different future? Had I rearranged that? Or was I merely an excuse for the rearrangement? I tried to shove off the doubts, but we were operating under some pressure. The wreckage of Nigel's marriage became less horrid when repurposed as a true love story, a meant-to-be affair so predestined that it couldn't have been helped, in fact, shouldn't have gone any other way. For if it had, we wouldn't be narrating it to 9 grandkids someday from our rockers on the porch, having long ago made one painful correction for the sake of a full, happy life. The whole premise worked if we ended up together, if I loved him and he loved me. We said these words to each other, but this time I made no promises to move to Australia. I tried to be bold in order to feel less weak. When I left Nigel, I did so on my terms. I told him I was going to end this next trip through Asia with a longer stay in Afghanistan, having banked some extra money during my last stint at home. Once there, I thought I'd try to get some paid work as a photographer. If he wanted to be with me, he could save his money and join me there. The next step belonged to him. Our lives, I said, could be fantastic. Chapter 11. Press Pass. That spring I made it to Afghanistan as I'd planned, moving into the Mustafa Hotel in downtown Kabul, negotiating a monthly rate and landing myself a small room with dark carpeting and a twin bed covered by a soft pink blanket. The Mustafa was famous, the place all the journalists had bunked at the outset of the American invasion of Afghanistan, when foreign correspondents first poured into the city. It had been one of the first places in post-Taliban Kabul to start serving alcohol. The era when it had teemed with journalists, though, had passed. As the war in Afghanistan dragged on, some of the press had moved into fortified compounds or guest houses that had been converted into news bureaus. Other media organizations didn't bother to keep a regular correspondent in Afghanistan, funneling their resources toward the other dragging-on war in Iraq. As a result, I'd heard that Afghanistan was a freelancer's paradise, rich in conflict but not overly populated with media. The barriers for people starting out were far lower than they were at home. Kabul, in May of 2007, resembled a stripped-down rock garden, with whole blocks of half-destroyed Soviet-style buildings followed by blocks of sprouting commerce. The dust off the plateau sat like a second skin on the faces of the raggedy kids who sold chewing gum and old maps on street corners. The crispness of the high-altitude air, lacquered by the motor buzz and stink of hundreds of diesel generators attempting to make up for missing infrastructure. I had business cards that read Amanda Lintout, freelance photographer, and listed my email address and new Afghan mobile phone number with the same words written in Dari, the most common language spoken in Afghanistan, on the back. I pressed them into the hands of everyone I encountered. At the Mustafa, I met a friendly photojournalist from England named Jason Howe, who charted his own way through the guerrilla war in Colombia, through the Israel-Hezbollah war in Lebanon in 2006, followed by a stint in Iraq. He was now en route to Helmand province to embed with the British troops. He explained the tenets of freelancing. You worked for yourself, paid for yourself, and assumed your own risk. You rode out the bumps, went without health insurance and long-term plans of any sort, and grew accustomed to being broke. When it came to assignments, you created your own, getting yourself to the most opportune spot. Nothing about this intimidated me. It did not, in fact, sound a whole lot different than the tenets of low-budget backpacking. I took pictures of everything I could, though I found it hard to photograph Afghans. Even women fully shielded behind burqas turned away from my lens. Men glared openly at me through my viewfinder. I had reconnected with Imanuddin, the rug seller I'd met a couple of years earlier. He'd relocated permanently from Peshawar to Kabul, where he'd opened another store. Thinking he might be able to help me, I asked whether he'd take me out to see the Kuchis, the nomadic people who camped in makeshift villages in the bald brown hills behind his extended family's house on Kabul's southern fringe, where I'd stayed during my first visit. There were Kuchis all over Afghanistan. Most were of Pashtun heritage. Some were more nomadic than others, moving across the highlands over seasons. You'd see the Kuchis walking the sides of otherwise remote roads with their sheep, the women wearing bright wool dresses with beaded bodices and wide sleeves, the men wrapped in scarves and topped by mushroom-shaped pakul hats. The few hundred living in the furrowed valleys beyond Imanuddin's house slept under a patchwork of woolen tents. The locals, the Afghans with land and homes, tolerated them, but mostly with distaste. The Kuchis reminded me a little bit of the First Nations people back in Canada, independent and unintegrated and pretty much worse off for it. Having packed all my camera gear and all my ambitions as a newly minted, not exactly making it, professional photographer, I proposed to Imanuddin that we spend the night at the Kuchi camp. His response was sharp. Why do you need this? Imanuddin's idea of a good time was listening to Bollywood music or bringing a picnic of lamb kebabs wrapped in newspaper and eating them on the shady banks of Karga Lake. It was clear there were limits to what he would do in the name of tour guiding. He did agree to walk me out to where the Kuchis were staying and make an introduction. The sun was beginning to dunk behind the hills as we approached, softening everything to a dusty plum. People were driving their herds of sheep and goats in toward camp for the evening. The scene had looked pretty and pastoral from a distance, but now I could smell the shit stink of hundreds of animals as they rivered closer. A turbaned man, dressed in loose white clothing and a brown vest, was moving toward us from the tents. The headman of the group, who introduced himself as Metin. After some conversation in Pashto with Imanuddin, Metin took me to the tent belonging to his sister, saying I could sleep there. Imanuddin continued to insist it was not a good idea to stay. Not safe, he said. But I was set on it. Giving me a suit-yourself shrug, he said he'd return for me in the morning and then loped back over the hills just ahead of the darkness. The headman's sister was in her 40s with a sun-weathered face and her hair in two matted braids. She wore a red dress patched with pieces of green wool. Metin loudly pronounced her name for me. Miriam. He then pronounced mine for her. Amalda. By way of bidding me goodnight, Metin touched his hand to his heart. I touched my hand to my heart in return. Miriam lifted the flap to her tent and waved me in. A small fire burned inside. Her two children wrestled on a carpet laid over the gravelly ground. Their possessions were stacked neatly in canvas bags against the tent's far wall. Miriam set about making us a dinner of rice and thick yogurt and naan, which we ate right out of the cooking pots, washed down with warm, sweet tea. After the meal, she swept the dirt floor and hauled several thick woolen blankets from the back of the tent. She took me outside so we could pee, side by side, on the hillside. Then the two of us lay awake, lit by the orange embers of the cooking fire, each propped up on an elbow, talking in our respective languages, aided by hand gestures, somehow never tiring of the effort. We discussed our families and the war, converting a thumbnail's worth of actual comprehension into something that, in the moment anyway, felt significant. When she couldn't make herself clear, Miriam laughed and reached for my hand as if to say, "Whatever, we are having ourselves a little bit of fun." From time to time, she leaned over and pulled the blankets higher over my shoulders. In the morning, stepping out of the dark tent into the white blare of sunlight, I was rewarded for having spent the night. Miriam and her Kuchi sisters-in-law, older women who clucked their approval of my presence, stroked my hair and pinned beaded amulets to my shirt. They showed me their own adornments, chunky stone necklaces from Saudi Arabia, silver earrings in the shape of crescent moons. I waited a while to pull out my camera, and when I did, it was not an event. The first time I lifted my viewfinder to my eye and pointed it at the women, nobody flinched. Nobody turned away or hid her children from me or gave me a single hostile look. Whatever assessment of me they'd needed had already been done, perhaps the second I'd step out of the tent with Miriam and her kids, all of us intact and no worse for the wear. The men drank tea in the shade of a tent. The women lined up goats for milking. A wizened grandmother type squatting outside one of the tents looked at me squarely and frankly with what felt like centuries living in her eyes, and in that split second, I let the shutter close. That picture, a close portrait of her spider-webbed wrinkles and gorgeous clear eyes, became my first published image. An editor at a local magazine for expats called Afghan Scene accepted it a few weeks later to run as a cover photo. She liked the image so much that she asked if she could print a copy to hang in her living room at home. She then commissioned me to go back and report a full feature-length story on the Coochies. A 3-page, 8-photo spread, written and photographed by me. By the standards of big-time journalists, it was nothing. A couple of sales to a low-budget magazine, a slim English-language monthly containing restaurant reviews and culture stories set between ads for everything from Visa cards to dog adoptions and armored cars. But for me, it was a score. It was an actual assignment, a little bit of money, the reward for going, and an excuse to stay. Encouraged now, I studied the websites of news magazines and newspapers. I paid attention to what people photographed, how the stories read. I forced myself to be extra outgoing and introduced myself to pretty much everyone passing through the Mustafa, asking questions about where they'd been and what they'd seen. I emailed editors in Toronto and New York, attaching photos I'd taken as I made short trips to different provinces, traveling with aid organizations or other freelancers from the Mustafa. Sometimes I got responses and requests to stay in touch, though never a commitment to publish what I'd sent. Most seemed to want only photographs of the war. One tactic among enterprising freelancers is to get letters of intent from editors or photo editors, a few short lines written on official letterhead, or an email with an official-sounding address, saying that he or she is interested in seeing, for example, your story on opium farmers who've taken up growing pistachios or images from your trip to the Tajiki border. The letters are vague with no guarantee of publication, but when they're forwarded to press officers or other gatekeepers, they function as gold. The only letter ever written on my behalf came to me by way of one of the Mustafa's many strange barflies, a pale Brit with a pronounced stutter named Anthony Malone, who, like a lot of the buzz-cut men in desert boots hanging around the downstairs lobby area, referred to himself obliquely as a private security contractor. He lived in a ritzy Kabul neighborhood in a mansion with staff. He knew people. He threw parties. He talked in a low voice into his cell phone. One night, over a beer at the bar, he told me that if I wanted to get an official military embed, he could help me out. Within a few days, he procured a letter from a buddy of his, an editor at a magazine called Combat and Survival, saying that he'd like to see any photos I could get of the Canadian troops in the field. The letter did the trick. Within a week, I was off to Kandahar. Combat and Survival is a publication geared towards soldiers, current soldiers, retired soldiers, and people obsessed, for whatever reason, with war and soldiering. Its pages, when I checked them out, featured reviews of monstrous-looking patrol vehicles and offered manly-sounding frontline reports from places like Serbia and Central Africa, the world's buzzing hotspots. I had no business working for it, but in truth, I was long past worrying about where and how I belonged. After 8 weeks in Afghanistan, I'd convinced myself that all I needed to do was to maneuver myself into a place where something newsworthy was going on. I touched down in Kandahar on a 115-degree afternoon in late June, lugging my photo equipment and peacock blue flak jacket, several sizes too big, which Abdullah, the friendly manager at the Mustafa, had dug out of his lost and found closet. Showing up at the press tent at Kandahar Airfield, I felt my nerves flutter. There was a team from Global News Television and Canwest Media and another guy from CTV. Serious reporters doing serious work, with their Pelican cases full of equipment, their satellite phones and ballistic-proof sunglasses and combat helmets. Shortly after my arrival, a dark-haired woman in a long white shirt breezed into the tent behind me, looking freshly showered and very much at home. I recognized her instantly as Melissa Fung, a national reporter for the Canadian Broadcast Corporation. I'd seen her on TV plenty of times, but now she was just 10 feet away from me, petite, confident, and not nearly as sweaty as the rest of us, busily conferring with her cameraman over a tripod-mounted video monitor. I felt like a kid standing alone in the school lunchroom. As I filled out the obligatory military paperwork, including an ominously worded next-of-kin contact sheet, one of the global news reporters walked over to introduce himself. His name was Francis Silvaggio. I did what I could to sound experienced. I was a photographer based in Kabul, I said. I'd flown down to shoot for combat and survival. As I was speaking, I saw his gaze settle on my Superman blue, extra, extra large flak jacket, which sat propped like a deli sandwich board on the ground next to my pack. "What is that?" he said. I sheepishly explained that it was body armor, old and too big and on loan from my hotel in Kabul. He lifted his eyebrows. "I'm a freelancer," I said, as if this weren't obvious. I waited for him to say something condescending or find a quick way out of the conversation, but he didn't. "You know," Francis said, "I think we've probably got an extra vest that'll fit you better." Before long, courtesy of Global News, I'd been outfitted in a snug and comparatively sleek Kevlar vest the color of dry leaves. In it, I felt less loserish. After being issued a helmet by the military public affairs officer, I seemed to fully blend in. A handful of us media people were heading to a forward operating base at a place called Masamgar, in one of those areas that got referred to in the news as a Taliban stronghold. We would drive an hour and a half in a convoy of light armored vehicles to get there. We got a procedure briefing from a commander before continuing. He reviewed the threat of roadside bombs, his instructions clipped and shouted. "If we're hit by an IED and there's no damage," he said, "we move on. If we're hit by an IED and there's a vehicle down, we will cordon it off and fight our way out if we need to." Taking advantage of what could be the last strong cell reception, the other reporters jumped on the phone with their editors, discussing story angles, arranging deadlines. I stepped out of the tent and called Nigel in Australia. I was feeling afraid. "We've grown distant already. Our rekindled relationship seemed to be waning quickly. One telephone call between us would be exuberant and loving, full of awe, babe, exclamations, and ideas about the future, while the next would be terse and detached. Nigel's divorce had become official, but instead of feeling like he had a new life and a fresh start, he seemed mostly depressed. Though I understood it, I didn't want to understand it. It was late afternoon in Australia. "I'm going out with the troops," I said to Nigel, launching into a description of my day thus far, explaining about my helmet and flak jacket, about the Taliban stronghold and the IEDs. Maybe it sounded like a boast. Maybe I knew that. We'd had a phone fight earlier in the week. He'd been saying he was coming to join me in Kabul, but he'd made no move to book flights. He'd accused me of being pushy. I'd accused him of being docile. "You won't hear from me for probably 10 days, I told him now, but don't worry, okay?" There was a pause. I pictured Nigel at work at a desk in a clean shirt, editing his photos of whatever had gone on that day in Bundaberg. "Okay, then," he said coolly, "just don't get killed." We hung up without a single endearment. I spent the next 8 days in the field with Canadian soldiers, mostly men my age from rural parts of Canada. It took only a brief dip in to understand that war was not just dangerous, but also a grind. The sun over southern Afghanistan roasted everything, the liquid soap in the latrines, the toilet seats, to almost scalding. Gear was heavy, the dust ubiquitous. I met a classical pianist who was worried about hurting his hands. I met a young father who kept laminated pictures of his children strung on a chain next to his dog tags. I met a couple of guys who passed their patrol time trading fantasies about the singer Nelly Furtado. On my second day at Masamgar, word came down that 3 Canadian soldiers had been killed by a roadside bomb during a patrol southwest of Kandahar. The embedded reporters immediately cranked into gear, waiting out the necessary blackout period while the families were contacted before shooting the news out into the universe. Soldiers lived inside the wire, within the protected confines of the military camp, but roamed, as needed and as ordered, on the outside. Inside the wire, there was a library, satellite television, and eggs cooked to order.